From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. On this Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we will take your calls on his philosophy of righteousness and what it holds for us today. We'll hear from ESPN's Howard Bryant about the state of Black America in 2020.
You want it to be our country. We fought for it. We bled for it. And then the minute you say something, anything that questions anything about this country, people say, well, maybe you don't belong here.
And we'll visit a shop in the North End where one woman represents change there.
One of my friends, her last name was Valente, so obviously she was Italian. She used to run down and get the slice of pizza and come back out because we were too afraid to come into the neighborhood.
But first, Boston's 50th annual Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Breakfast. It's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston. Radio Boston, I'm Tiziana Deering, and today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and we're going to spend the hour reflecting on his legacy and also how race remains an essential part of our national conversation in 2020. To start, this morning was the 50th annual Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Breakfast in Boston, and WBUR Simone Rios was there. He joins us now in the studio. Welcome back, Simone.
Thanks very much.
So give us a sense of this morning's event.
You know, it was the 50th anniversary, and the place was packed. It's a truly jubilant event, if you've ever been there, full of community leaders and, of course, politicians and activists. The keynote came from Bishop Michael Curry, not to be confused with Michael Curry, formerly
Friend of Radio Boston.
That's right, the Episcopal Church. He kept insisting that he wasn't delivering a sermon but a keynote, but he certainly invoked the spirit of Dr. King with his words. Here he talks about Thomas Jefferson. After acknowledging Jefferson's hypocrisy as a slave owner who fathered children with one of his slaves, Sally Hemings.
He may have been wrong, but the words were right. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men, all folk are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Human equality, human dignity is not conferred by Congress. It is decreed by the Lord God Almighty.
So that's incredibly powerful. Were there other moments that stood out to you as well?
One of the high points, certainly for the crowd, came from Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley. Her message was about the continuing struggles of Black folks and people of color. She said in her congressional district, African Americans are at the bottom of nearly every social and economic indicator, and that King's dream won't be fully realized until those inequalities are addressed. Pressley also talked about not feeling the need to be apologetic for standing up for certain groups.
And I tell you, Black folks are in the bottom of every category, and then you want me to be an apologist for saying that I am fighting for the economic empowerment and advancement and preservation of Black folk. Not only. Speaker Pelosi says that she's in Congress for the children, the children, the children. Do any of you say, what about the adults? No. Only women and people of color are asked to be apologists for fighting for their very preservation.
Sounds like there was a morning of a lot of powerful messages. I do understand that there was an interesting moment involving Governor Baker and Representative Pressley. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, you could call it interesting. Governor Baker was next to speak on a panel that also involved Marty Walsh and Ed Markey. Let's just listen to how he addresses having to speak after Pressley.
I'm sitting here thinking that the mayor made a smart strategic move.
sitting
over there.
Let's switch seats. Charlie,
the only thing I can add to that rant, okay, is this.
It was a little TED talk.
Yeah, so that rant comment elicited a few groans from the audience, as you could tell. Some people chalked it up to misspeaking or an attempt at humor, but other people were fuming about it, calling it a microaggression or a kind of Freudian slip. I spoke to newly elected Boston City Councilor Ricardo Arroyo after the breakfast.
I think he should have an opportunity to explain what he meant by the word rant, but it was certainly a misstep and an inappropriate usage to me of what she had so eloquently stated in these universal truths that people of color know to be true through their own lived experiences.
Has the governor explained? Has he had a response?
Yeah, we checked in with his office afterward, and Communications Director Lizzie Guyton said the governor agreed with Presley's remarks and found her speech to be moving. Baker's office said the governor actually reached out to Ayanna Pressley after the breakfast to apologize for using the word rant.
All right, let's go out on a little more of that gospel choir music while we thank WBUR Simone Rios. Thanks for being with us today, Simone.
Good to be here, as always.
Appreciate it. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. often taught and spoke of a concept of righteousness, an outrage about and response to deep moral injury. And in the depths of those teachings, he embraced righteous anger while exhorting righteous love. This was not some acceptance of injustice or a compromise, but instead an unfailing commitment to call out the injustice without ever succumbing to hate for the unjust. Here is Dr. King in his 1957 sermon, Loving Your Enemies.
The person who hates you most has some good in him. Even the nation that hates you most has some good in it. Even the race that hates you most has some good in it. And when you come to the point that you look in the face of every man and see deep down within him what religion calls the image of God, you begin to love him in spite of, no matter what he does, you see God's image there. And that is an element of goodness that he can never slough off.
As we struggle through arguably one of the most divided times in our nation, with Richmond, Virginia today, for example, in a state of emergency over worries of violence during a Second Amendment protest there, we wanted to explore the richness of this righteousness idea that Dr. King taught and practiced and ask what it means for our moment. So here to help us is Kelly Carter-Jackson, assistant professor in the Department of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. Welcome back, Kelly.
Hi, thank you.
Also with us is Brandon Terry, assistant professor of African and African American Studies and Social Studies at Harvard University. Welcome back to you, Brandon.
Thank you.
And we'd like you to join this conversation, too. This is hard stuff, calling out injustice, feeling anger at it while practicing love for the other. What do you think? Is that the message for our moment? Or are we in a moment of anger without love? Do we need a moment of love that doesn't ignore the world's injustice? How do we get there? Pull up a chair. Call us. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Kelly, Brandon, is righteousness a message for our moment? Kelly, why don't you start?
Definitely. I mean, I don't think there's ever a moment where we don't need righteousness, right? I think that when we think of it in terms of race and racial reconciliation, righteousness is needed more than ever. But I think that in order to talk about righteousness, we do have to talk about righteous anger. We do have to talk about the harm that people have been caused and the anger and grief that people experience, particularly people of color and Black people more specifically. And I think a lot of the efforts to talk about race righteousness has dismissed the ability for Black people to be angry and to talk about the ways that they have been marginalized and discriminated against and oppressed for, you know, hundreds of years.
You know, Brandon, I think about this message of anger and love. I'm acutely aware that as a white woman, for me to say, oh, don't forget the love part can very much sound like don't forget the part where it's okay for white people. So how do we understand what the depth of the concept of righteousness, as Dr. King wanted us to understand it? What really is that?
Well, he always warned against people using these concepts of love or fairness or even something like moderation more cynically. He warned against people who would use those to discipline legitimate Black protest, right? So even in the midst of something as frightening as the riots of the late 1960s, King was adamant that people don't dismiss these legitimate grievances, that they try to understand why people were so angry and frustrated with their situation. And the righteousness part for King is in part guarding against self-righteousness.
Say some more about that.
So that when he, in this sermon, Loving Your Enemies, one of the first things he says is, what love requires you to do is to perform a kind of self-inventory, a self-interrogation, to ask, why is it that people are expressing certain forms of outrage or distrust or disappointment in you? And is there anything that you have done or that you might be entangled with or that might be going on in your society that's causing people to have that reaction? And he asked that of Black protesters, but he also asked that of the broader society. And so what I think people need to do is that instead of just resorting to using King as a way of bludgeoning legitimate protest, is taking his own recommendation, which is to do that kind of self-inventory, that self-examination, to try to understand what might elicit outrage. And he says that even on the international level, which, as you can see, is all shot through our imperial politics at present.
Mm-hmm. I would completely agree with that. One of the quotes I used from him the most is where he says, a riot is the language of the unheard. A riot is the language of the unheard. And in saying that, he's really calling us to listen and to say, in the ways when we see Black people or people of color, quote unquote, acting out and enraged by what racism has caused them, that is the moment to listen. That is the moment to try to communicate in a way that is most effective. And these are people that have been unheard, that have been denied, that have not been listened to. And riots or violence becomes the one way of sort of triggering someone's attention and hopefully triggering someone's ability to be able to listen to the point of pain that people are dismayed about.
It is so hard to be still when being confronted with one's own bad acts. So hard to be still and listen when being called out. I think even in, you know, family life, in my home life, you know, sometimes I am in the wrong and it is hard to sit still and listen to that. Did he offer, as a pastor, guidance on how to be still and listen when confronted with the injustice that maybe you perpetrate?
Well, part of, let me go at that question a slightly
any
different
way
angle.
You want.
Sure. So, part of what the admonition toward love is trying to do is bring people to that moment of self-reflection, right? So he's King is actually, you know, he's a very educated guy. He's very steeped in the leading psychological research of the period, and he's extremely aware of all of the ways in which people's fear of being confronted with their wrongdoing manifests itself in these incredibly creative ways of evading responsibility. Right. And so what love is an attempt to do is try to show, even in the middle of contentious politics and righteous anger, that we have goodwill for people we disagree with, that all of us are more than the worst we've ever done, and that we are willing to go on in political community with you and share the earth with you, despite the fact that you are in the wrong at present. And when you demonstrate those things to people through your acts and your words, it tends to have a better effect in turning people's emotional stance and their ability to reason toward the kinds of claims toward justice that you're making.
Let's take our first call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join in the conversation. Michael from Roxbury, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm reminded, you know, the point that Martin Luther King made, and, you know, even in the context of race, class, creed, and culture, that there's this basis of humanity, that we all have this responsibility, you know, to ourselves and to one another. And so what that says to me, it's not enough to keep pointing the finger at other people as the source of my problems, that, you know, there's a responsibility that I have, you know, just across the board in terms of, you know, my people, my community, my family, people right in my neighborhood, you know, just to exemplify the point that he was making.
Thanks for that, Michael. Kelly, let me invite you to respond to Michael.
Sure. Yeah, I think that I think the solutions are twofold, meaning when we think about where do we go from here and how do we create progress? Personal responsibility is definitely a big aspect of that, but I would not make that the sole responsibility. I do think that personal responsibility has to go hand in hand with collective responsibility, that just as much as we have to own the ways that we are responsible for the choices that we make, I think white Americans really have to own the choices that they have made to be privileged by, to benefit by, to be advantaged by whiteness and how whiteness operates in this country. And that we do have to have honest discussions about that. And I think that where Black people have always been willing to own sort of their personal responsibility white people have been very reluctant to own their privileges or their advantages that come from whiteness. So having both sides of that conversation, I think, is really important.
Do you think we're making progress, Brandon, and people's sort of across the spectrum? I'm going to rephrase that question. You got to rephrase one of my questions, so I'm going to rephrase one of my questions now. Where are we in this time of social media where the accusations fly? Mm-hmm. Where are we in introspection and accepting responsibility for how we both contribute to and damage in any way that might be the world around us? And then specifically when it comes to racial injustice.
Sure. One of the things that King was very influenced by the very famous German philosopher Hegel, and he would always talk about things as a process of unfolding through opposites. And I say all that just to say that I think we're in a weird moment where it's easy to get frustrated with social media, and I certainly get frustrated with social media because it seems so angry. The impulses are all toward humiliation. We are in a call-out culture, a cancel culture, mm-hmm. And people have real anxieties about that are reasonable. People don't want to be piled on by a mob of anonymous people. People don't want to be humiliated in public that way. But I think part of what we're reckoning with is that for the first time in American history, there's a leveling out of the power of criticism. Right.
That's really interesting.
In U.S. history, it's always been who controls the media, who can get a media platform. Those are the people that have the power of criticism. And now even the media itself is subjected to mm-hmm. criticism, that there can be an outcry when the headlines aren't the right way, the captions of the pictures aren't the right way. And I think we're dealing with a lot of anxiety about that democratization. But I think King also offers us some ways to synthesize that and to move beyond so that people stop simply enjoying the newfound power that they have and being informed only by outrage, but start to see, well, if this is a process about correction, if this is a process about growing transformation, then maybe we can temper these criticisms with a little bit of loving sentiment, a stance toward the idea that people can improve, they can grow, they can learn. If we've got a diagnosis that society is very, very shot through with racism, we are going to have to expect people to make mistakes. And we're going to have some off-ramp where people can learn to grow and the culture can improve as a outgrowth of that.
That's Brandon Terry of Harvard University. We're talking with him and Kelly Carter Jackson of Wellesley College about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s teaching on righteousness. And we'd like you to join the conversation. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I think I'll take another call here. We've got Sarah on the line from Jamaica Plain. Join us, Sarah.
Yes. Well, thank you very much for the conversation. I have been inspired by Dr. King's work, especially his book, The Strength to Love. And what I wanted to add to the conversation is a poem that engages all of us to think about our humanity. It says, "Are you greater than the sun that shines on everyone, black, brown, yellow, red, and white? The sun does not discriminate."
Thanks for that, Sarah. Kelly, what other messages did Dr. King bring forward to help us work our way through the moment of reckoning about race that we find ourselves or are trying to find ourselves in as a country now?
Yeah, I think especially towards the end of his life, you know, we see a lot of these victories that happen with the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. But right on the heels of all of this great big legislation is the beginning of a new Black Power movement. And that Black Power movement really is a response to the lack of ability to address Black needs in a full spectrum. And so there's this great moment when in 1966, King is giving a speech among a Black audience and he gets booed. And, you know, I think people are shocked to read that because they're like, Martin Luther King gets booed? What? And, you know, he didn't say like, do you know who I am? You know, he really owned it. And he said, "I've gotten booed because we've been preaching to them this dream for years. And this dream has turned into a nightmare. And he realizes that in order for Black people to really assert their full humanity, it has to go beyond the vote. It has to go into practical things like jobs, like education. This is why the Poor People's Movement was next on his agenda. You know, he really moved from civil rights to human rights. And I think that he started to see how big these problems were and that in a lot of ways, we had gotten civil rights on the cheap, that it wasn't costing people anything. They weren't having to dig into their pockets or sacrifice to really create this kind of change. And so when King starts pushing more and more for people to have to actually do that, he's talking about forfeiture of power. He's talking about redistribution of sources. I think that makes people really uncomfortable. But those are the hard conversations we have to have if we move beyond, if we're to move beyond sort of this performative aspect of progress and into the real substance of progress. When I say the performative aspects, I mean, now when we look at our activism, it's very hashtag, right? You can sort of hashtag Black Lives Matter.
You can signal.
Yeah, you can signal to this, and it's all about performance, and it doesn't create real substance. It certainly doesn't create policy change. And so how do we move beyond the imagery of a movement and really into the things that will create meaningful change in people's lives? That's something I think we're still struggling with, and I think that's definitely something that King was struggling with towards the end of his life, this inability to create change on the bottom.
I recognize that Letter from a Birmingham Jail is from earlier in his life, but I do want to bring in some sound, some of his voice reading that letter. Let's start with a little bit of an excerpt, and then I'll give some more context.
For years now, I have heard the word wait. It rings in the ear of every Negro with piercing familiarity. This wait has almost always meant never. We must come to see with one of our distinguished jurists that justice too long delayed is justice denied.
There's a larger context in which he's calling out what he calls the white moderate for feeling entitled to determine when another group of human beings can experience their liberation and freedom. And he talks about the realities of Black people who face daily discrimination, dehumanization through segregation, police brutality. He goes on to say this.
When you are harried by day and haunted by night by the fact that you are a Negro, living constantly at tiptoe stance, never quite knowing what to expect next, and are plagued with inner fears and outer resentments, when you are forever fighting a degrading and degenerating sense of nobodiness, then you will understand why we find it difficult to wait.
Brandon, the voice is calm, but the message is strong. It's angry and it's impatient and it's prophetic, to use that religious term of the prophetic voice. I've heard a number of scholars say that we have adopted a convenient picture of Dr. King since his passing. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the sharpness and really strong prophetic nature of the life of his message.
Yeah, I wrote a piece for the Boston Review a few years ago on the 50th anniversary of King's assassination, where I talked at length about what I call the cost of canonization. And partly it was about a certain kind of reconciliatory project. Partly it was about a group of Black activists situated around Coretta Scott King trying to keep King in the conversation for the long haul. But one of the things that happened in the course of that compromise is that we sanded down the more radical edges. In fact, most of us tend to think of King as not a particularly original thinker, somebody who's simply dramatizing through his activism and his rhetoric the deep message of American democracy forever. But that's not King. I mean, even as early as the 1950s, King has a deep skepticism toward whether capitalism in its 20th century form can deliver on the promise of liberal notions of justice and equality. He has a profound recognition of all the ways in which race structures disadvantage, both in the objective sense of how much money do people have, what kind of employment is available to people, but also in the subjective sense, the sense of nobodiness, the sense that when you speak up, it doesn't matter, that your voice is only heard on the terms of sufferance from others, that if somebody else lifts your voice up, perhaps you might get a hearing, but otherwise you're not someone who's a co-creator of this society. King understood that kind of rot at the core of American civilization. And to me, the big thing that changes about him over the course of his life is not really the diagnosis. It's what he's willing to do to challenge it, that he starts to see mass civil disobedience as one of the only answers, that he starts to see really taking on the American military-industrial complex as part of the answer here, that that's part of what's eating at our ability to deliver fairness and justice in the economic realm and the social realm. And so if that's not the king we're talking about, right, if the king that we have is only seen as an icon to the people who live in Roxbury because they're people of African descent and not to the people in Fields Corner who are people of Vietnamese descent, right, that's a sanded down, manipulated king. The king that we should know is a king that's got a prophetic message for all of us around the world and one of the only messages that can defeat the kind of evils we're seeing at present.
Kelly, we have about a minute left in there.
I wholeheartedly agree with all of that. And I feel, you know, in some ways, Martin Luther King Day has kind of become a little upsetting for me because it's become this like day of service where people go pick up trash. And I'm like, what does this have to do? This is not Earth Day. Like, what does this have to do with MLK? And I think that's because we have this sort of like Disney Presents King, where we have this very sanitized, very comfortable, very complacent version of a person that doesn't make us feel uncomfortable, that doesn't compel us to do anything other than, you know, have a good breakfast and pick up trash, right? And I want to be able to move beyond that, beyond the performance of memory, and really into something that creates policy change. So if we used MLK Day to say, let's register voters, if we used MLK Day to really talk about systemic issues and how we might change them, obviously this is going to take place over more than the course of a day, but it would be something that would feel much more substantial than what we're currently doing.
Well, that's our that's as much time as we have. We have to go to a break, but I will say, I think one of the things I'll take away from this conversation is this idea to begin with sitting still, self-reflecting, and listening to painful messages as a part of this practice of righteousness. That was Kelly Carter Jackson, assistant professor in the Department of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Also with us, Brandon Terry, assistant professor of African and African American Studies and Social Studies at Harvard University. Thanks so much.
It was a pleasure.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tisiana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering. For ESPN's Howard Bryant, the election of Donald Trump in 2016 was personal. In a new collection of essays out tomorrow, the Northampton-based writer says that the election was, quote, a proud and unhidden repudiation of the nation's first black president, unquote. The book was conceived while Bryant was writing about sports, but it explores a much broader set of systems in which he argues the American dream by design is not open to African Americans. Bryant's collection of essays is Full Dissidence, Notes from an Uneven Playing Field. He joins us now from the studios of New England Public Radio in Springfield. Howard Bryant, welcome back to Radio Boston.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
So, Howard, why'd you write this book?
Well, I think that there are lots of reasons. That I think that what happens is that when you're working on projects, my last book, The Heritage, which was all about the empowerment of African-American athletes, as for all of those decades where the players hadn't gotten involved and suddenly you see LeBron James and you see so many other players, Colin Kaepernick, getting involved, I also began to ask myself another question. And that question was, how much power do these athletes actually have when you risk everything, when you lose your career simply by opening your mouth and advocating for an African-American position, for a black position? And so I started to think about the different ways that sports may have been a piece of that book, but it was time to go outside of it and think much more broadly about the different ways that you could see the culture changing, combining what was taking place both with the election and then also what was happening with policing, militarization, wealth inequality, all of these different things. These different ideas seemed to come taking me to one spot, and it was really something that I couldn't ignore anymore.
You heard in the lead that I talked about the fact that for you, the election of Donald Trump was personal and that you called it a repudiation of the nation's first black president. Clearly, there are going to be listeners who say, I voted for Donald Trump for a number of reasons. It had to do with the economy. It had to do with my concern about the coasts of the country not caring about me. How do you square those arguments with your very clear argument in your essays that that election was about race?
Well, because of the company you keep. And I think that you follow those statements, you follow what he said, you follow what he hasn't said. I find it very, very difficult to see those arguments as credible based on anything that's come out of his mouth. And also when you look at the reaction to things such as Charlottesville and many other examples, just too numerous to count, I think that the that argument to me is insulting. And I think that it's actually part of the problem. And I think that's one of the reasons why I wrote this book, because I didn't want to debate. I'm not here to change anyone's mind. My idea was to write something from a perspective. I think in your last segment, you were talking about who controls the lens, who gets to do the speaking, who gets to do the talking. And one of the reasons why I wrote this book was because I felt there was so much emphasis on those Trump voters and on those people trying to explain why they did what they did and telling us that what we were experiencing wasn't the things that we've been experiencing for many, many years. I felt it was time, when you have the opportunity to speak from your perspective. And that was the real genesis of this.
The very first words of the book are, to be black is to be a dissident. And of course, the book is called Full Dissidents. Explain what you mean.
Well, what I meant by that was thinking about the different ways in which you pay an enormous price simply for embracing an African-American position. If you embrace a black position, you know, especially coming from sports, you look at Colin Kaepernick, you look at Tommy Smith and John Carlos and Muhammad Ali. There are so many different examples of this that you see that your very presence simply by caring about your community puts you at a disadvantageous position, puts your career in jeopardy, puts your livelihood in jeopardy. And when you look at it that way and you expand it across so many different other different areas, even when we're talking about education, if you're talking about residence and housing and everything, simply your presence creates conflict. And that's one of the big issues here when you talk about ownership of this American dream, when you talk about something that belongs to you. How can something belong to you when your presence puts everything that you have in jeopardy and that people go out of their way to try and deny your existence in so many ways, to tell you that what you're feeling is invalid? And I felt that it was important to be in a position to talk about this, to write about it from a perspective, a black perspective that was not trying to go and convince people that we belong. I simply felt that I was going to write what I had to say.
You said a minute ago, you pay an enormous price just by embracing an African-American position. You do that full on in this book. Are you expecting that you will pay an enormous price?
No. It's a price that I continue to pay. This is what happens. I go through this quite often with many athletes when we talk about race. When you walk into a clubhouse and you're talking to ball players and you ask them anything that is even remotely race, it may not even be controversial. It just may have a racial component. They look at you as if you're trying to get them released or traded. They know the backlash. They know the backlash from the potential backlash from ownership, from teammates, from talk radio, from media, from fans. And that is one of the real centers of this project, where you look at it and you say, okay, all I'm doing is asking you about your experience. And these players will look at you as if they know that they are risking anything just to be candid. They're risking everything to be candid. And so what does that tell you about the position that they're in? What does that tell you about the position that all of us are in? And from a journalism perspective, the number of times I've heard so many black writers, and there aren't very many of us that have the opportunity to say these things, who will say, well, I don't want to be a black writer. I just want to be a writer. These are conversations you never hear from anyone else. You never hear an Irish writer repudiating their own Irishness. They incorporate it into their work. They're proud of what it brings to their work. Yet when it comes to African Americans, we are constantly told to erase very important parts of our identity. And that's what this collection is all about. It's about making sure that your identity is something that isn't the worst thing in the world, as one of the essays is.
Let's bring some of the voice of the book to the listeners. The Tennesses are very personal, and one of them you write about growing up in Dorchester. Your parents enrolled you and your sister in the Metco program, and you were bused to school in a Newton Village, Waubun. I'm wondering if you could read a brief passage on page 77 where you say a little bit about the Metco program.
Sure. It says, "For all the triumph, an obvious question was not asked. Why, after half a century, is Metco still necessary? 50 years later, the black kids in their communities are still running from the violence, their parents still getting them up at 5 a.m., still with a school nobody wants to go to just a few blocks away, often still underserving the community. As the retrospectives piled up in Boston, the outrage that 50 years later many black parents still believe the best educational opportunities for their children is to put them on a bus for a daily 3-hour round-trip commute to school, reinforcing the belief that becoming a member of the Lost Tribe is a necessity, was largely and curiously non-existent."
That's ESPN's Howard Bryant reading from his new collection of essays, Full Dissidence. So there's a lot there. I think the first thing I want to ask you is, explain the Lost Tribe you're talking about.
Yeah, the Lost Tribe that essay is all about kids who grew up the way my family grew up, the way my sister and my younger sister grew up, which is those black families in the 70s and growing up in Dorchester. We weren't part of all the busing stuff that was going on at the time because we were enrolled in Metco, in the voluntary program. So we had to get up at 6 in the morning, and we went to schools that were predominantly white. We went to school in Waubun. And then the family, after the neighborhood was starting to change even more in Dorchester, we moved down to Plymouth. And it was a real interesting and devastating trade of one set of violence for another, where now you are in this community where you're the only black kid in class for pretty much the rest of your schooling. And what did that do? What was the impact of that? And why were we there? Obviously, it was for your education. And that's what this collection is all about. That's what this essay is all about this lost tribe of being placed against this white backdrop. And what's really interesting about it from the standpoint, as New Englanders know, is that the same white flight that was taking place, black families were doing the same thing. So when we got to Plymouth, our neighbors were the very same folks from Dorchester and Southie and Eastie that were trying to get away from us. So it was extremely tense. It was a very, very difficult time. But when we think about it, what was all of this for? This was for education. This was for your family trying to give you that piece of the American dream, to give you something that we were told you needed in order to survive.
Howard, we have heard about the system is broken, the system is rigged, about injustice and inequality for years. I felt like I heard a different argument out of these essays. I felt like the argument I heard from you, if I may, is the system is actually flawless, perfectly designed to keep whiteness in power and in place, and is working effectively to do so. And that there are the threat to that flawless system leads to violence, oppression, and a fight to keep it in place. Did I read you right?
No, you read it perfectly right. And I think that's one of the feelings as we were talking about the necessity of this book now. Why did I write this book now? It was because of that feeling. It was this idea that when you are part of this as an American, especially as a black American, the things that you do, you are told if you do these right things, if you get the good grades, if you go to the right schools, if you have the two-parent household, if you do all of these different things, you're going to be accepted, that part of this dream will belong to you. And also on the part of your white neighbors and my white friends and all of these friends that I've had my whole life, this attitude had also been that we're not perfect, it's not perfect, but it's getting better, that there's an aspirational sense to this American dream that we all have. And yet I felt after the election in 2016 that that's not what I feel now. What I feel, the message that is being sent across the country, is if you don't like it, leave, that this is who we are. It feels like it's a complete reclaiming. And when you think about what's happening in the news today, you look at the pro-gun rally and you see these hordes and hordes of armed whites in camouflage, and you don't really see It's not a multicultural gathering there. You look at it and it feels like the reclaiming that I talk about in the book. And I begin to ask myself these questions. Where are we right now? What is actually being said to us? And that's why the last section of the book, the last essay, is called Renters. Is this yours? No matter how many schools you build if you're LeBron James, no matter how many gold medals you win if you're an Olympian, and no matter how many times you do the right thing as just as a black citizen, can this belong to you? And why is this reflex so – just by asking, why is it so obvious that people feel like they can tell you to go back to Africa or go back where you came from, or if you don't like it, leave? Is this piece yours? Is any of this really truly belonging to you?
We've only got a minute left or so before I have to go to a break. I do want to – one of the things that I thought about as a white person and a white woman reading this book is new ideas and uncomfortable ideas. We should struggle with them. We should grapple with them. But it seems like engaging in pushback of any kind would simply invite, well, that's because you're white and that's just part of you not getting it. So how does one engage with and struggle with the content of your book as a white person? And I'm sorry, I've given you 30 seconds for that.
30 seconds for the toughest question.
Right, no, sorry.
I think it's an opportunity. And I think it's an opportunity. And I think it's something that you can learn about being black. This is what we go through every single day. We have to figure out a way to live in this culture. And if you are interested in where we are, if you're interested in how we think, this is an invitation, as far as I'm concerned, to understand perspectives that we all say we care about. And now we can hear it and find out if we really do.
Howard Bryan is a senior writer for ESPN based in Northampton, Massachusetts. His new book is Full Dissidence, Notes from an Uneven Playing Field. He'll be at the Harvard Bookstore on February 3rd. There's more information about the book and his event on our website, radioboston.org. Howard Bryan, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll visit a shop in the North End where one woman represents change there. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. And finally today, Radio Boston's Paris Alston is taking us to the North End as part of our series, Paris in Boston. We head to Salem Street, where among the many ristorantes and trattorias, there is a hive of natural, honey-based toothpaste and shampoo, and plenty of the sweet stuff itself. It's a shop called Ivy's Everything Honey, and it's reported to be the first business in the North End owned by a person of color. Paris went to talk to the owner of the store, Ivy Lawson, who began by talking about how the business came to be.
I had a bee infestation in my basement, and this was years ago. There were it seemed like a million bees was stuck in a back room. They made hives and they made honey near the heating system. And I tried the honey, and lo and behold, it was very different from what I was used to getting, you know, the honey that comes in that teddy bear, you know, squirting thing. So there's a difference in a taste and the way honey, raw honey, react to your system rather than the honey that people sell in with, you know, that might not be honey. And even if it's honey, it's boiled, it's strained, you know, they have some manipulation going on with it. So it doesn't taste the same.
So why did you decide to turn honey into a business?
Okay, and that's a really great question. My son had a really bad acne, and that was the first thing I made was an acne cleanser. And when I made it, I said to myself, you know, I could use a 5-gallon bucket, could give me about 5,000 units of that acne medicine,
wow.
Whereas it only gave me 84 jars of honey. So it was kind of, you know, saying I can use the same thing with raw honey, you know, incorporate it into the products that I make and get more use out of it in terms of volume. So that's, you know, it just makes sense.
You've made history by being the first person of color to own a business in the North End.
Of Boston,
and
yeah.
The North End of Boston. And we know that the North End is a very historically Italian neighborhood, you know, very tight-knit, close-knit. Why did you pick this location?
I was looking all around Boston. We went everywhere from Dorchester to Dudley to Newberry Street. And I remember coming here and I parked across the street. And this building, this little space was very very bad condition. So I had to look beyond, you know, the appearance that I saw. And it just spoke to me. And it wasn't like I'm going to target in North End. Making history was a surprise to me. And I think at first I wasn't really comfortable with it because we're in 2018. Come on. Why am I making history? So I felt a little uncomfortable. But, you know, I realized in this country there are many barriers that needs to be broken and, you know, are taken down.
And how, I mean, it wasn't always like that for you with the North End. Tell me about how you perceived this neighborhood when you were younger, when you were growing up.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, I grew up in Boston in the 70s, and it was a challenging time. You know, Boston is very segregated. I mean, you know, there are common areas, but for the most part, it's, you know, the Italians live in the Italian North End, Southie was for predominantly Irish, and different, you know, parts of it sectioned out. That's just the way it was. I love pizza. That's like, I love Italian food. I'm not going to lie. I remember, you know, as a kid, you know, teenager, trying to get a slice of authentic Italian pizza that I would stand like close to Haymarket. And one of my friends, her last name was Valente, so obviously she was Italian. She used to run down and get the slice of pizza and come back out because we were too afraid to come into the neighborhood. At least I was.
What had instilled that fear in you about coming into the North End? I mean, what had you heard or seen or read that was going on here that was making people of color feel unwelcome?
Well, I just think that, you know, it's, you know, the maybe fallacies of saying, oh, the Italians and mafioso and all that kind of stuff, which is probably not even real. But you are, you know, those are the idea that's instilled in you, you know, based on what you see on television or what you hear about communities. So it's just, I can't believe I'm here, given those memories that, you know, that I live long enough to see the changes made and then I'm a part of the community.
What do you hope that your presence will say to not only the North End, but the rest of Boston?
You know what? In terms of economic development in a city, we are part of the city. And I know Boston have this awful reputation about not being inclusive and not being, you know, people, when you hear about touring Boston, it stops. You know, there's a boundary. It doesn't go into Roxbury and it doesn't go into Dorchester, parts of Dorchester or even Mattapan. And I just think it's just wrong. I mean, it's like it doesn't really give the full picture of what the city is about. So, I mean, I think I'm you know, making a difference and I'm changing the landscape of how we look. When I first moved here, I'm not going to lie, I was very tempted to say I'm not the owner of this store. Very, can you believe it? Ask my managing director. I was like, I don't want anybody to know that I own this.
Wow, why was that?
Because I just felt like it was going to put a damper on my business, that people would not patronize my business. And that they would be like, I'm not going to. But it's been the opposite. So there you go. And I remember my friend, he said to me, you are the face of the business. How can you not, you know, and how can you not embrace it? I remember even when we were doing the renovation, I did a lot of the painting, the work that I could do, painting the shelves and so on. And people would come in and said, what's going in here? And I'm like, I don't know. You know, I would be like, I don't know. I'm just a painter. Can you see? No, I mean, wow. I was very, yeah, it's sad. It really, and I know better. I travel a lot. But even across my mind, I thought, I'm not going to make any money here if people know I own the business. You know, and that's not true, though, because people have taught me differently. I had probably one person who came in here who kept asking, why did you come here? Why did you come here? And I was like, would you like a sample of toothpaste? And he goes, I would never buy anything from you. I was like, I didn't know. He kept asking the question. I didn't know what else to say. And I knew what he was implying, but I don't want to go there. So I just said, just take a sample of toothpaste. Trust me, your teeth will be, your gums will love you. He was like, no, I wouldn't buy anything. But my father would love it. So I think I changed his mind.
Bridging the gap with honey.
Exactly. Exactly.
That was Ivy Lawson, owner of Ivy's Everything Honey in the North End, speaking with Paris Alston as part of our series, Paris and Boston. And that's our show for today. Listeners, the Senate impeachment trial resumes tomorrow afternoon. WBUR will offer special coverage throughout the trial. Tune in to 90.9 WBUR or WBUR.org to hear it. And in the meantime, the Radio Boston team will be standing by to bring you the latest on that and all the news every chance we get. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.